Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
If you're looking at your phone right now, you've found us on mobile, which means we can get a move on. You know me, you know what this is, so let's begin.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. And today is a day of mourning for the 150 victims of Germanwings Flight 9525. Mourners gathered alongside German President Joachim Gauck in the German city of Haltern today. That comes to us from German television RTL. As new information emerges about the final moments before Germanwings Flight 9525 is believed to have been deliberately crashed into the French Alps. In response, airlines around the world are reevaluating their cockpit policies. Yesterday, Canadian officials announced a revised policy to require two people in the cockpit at all times. Now, this is a policy that's been in place in the United States for many years, and now four European airlines are doing the same. We're also learning more about the co-pilot, Andreas Lubitz. French prosecutors say he had a medical condition that he hid from his employer, that's Germanwings. German investigators said they did not find any kind of suicide note in Lubitz's home, but they did find a torn-up doctor's note allowing him time off work because of an illness. At the same time, there are reports in German media that Lubitz suffered from depression. Jeff Wise is the author of the Kindle single, The Plane That Wasn't There, Why We Haven't Found MH370. He joins me in the studio now. Jeff, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Jeff, you're a pilot, and I want to get your perspective as a pilot here. What questions do you still have about how this crash happened?
Almost every question I still have. It's a very strange case. There have been cases in the past in which pilots fly their plane into the ground, killing themselves and everyone aboard, but they are very, very rare, and they are shrouded in mystery because very rarely do they leave pilot's notes. Very rarely do you hear on the audio recording from the cockpit voice recorder an explanation or, you know, an exclamation of why they're doing this. And so the few cases that it has happened, we don't really know why it happened. There's often talk of marital discord or financial troubles, but it's hard to go from, you know, depression, stress to this really unbelievable act of killing yourself and, you know, over 100 people.
Right. And mass murder. Well, in a way, it's not different than what a bus driver could do if they chose, or somebody driving a car could deliberately crash it.
That's so true.
In a way, it's not different from that. It's just on a grander scale.
Right. I mean, you could draw a line between something like this and the different kinds of murder, suicide that take place with disturbing frequency in society. People walking into a movie theater with an automatic weapon, for instance. But I would, you know, another answer to your question is pilots are different kinds of people. I'm a recreational pilot. I can't claim to be one of these guys, commercial pilots who spent so many thousands of hours in the air. In this case, he was a fairly low-time pilot, just about 600 hours. But still, someone who had dedicated his life to the love of flying. These are people who are self-motivated, disciplined, who are doing something that a lot of people are scared to fly at all. These people are doing it day in and day out. And so I don't think you can liken it really to a disgruntled post office employee, for instance.
Right. A lot of it is so hard to process because the other imperative of pilots, especially commercial pilots, of course, is safety and shepherding their passengers safely to their destination. And that's why this is so very hard, among other reasons, for a lot of people to process. Let me ask you about regulations and rules. Is it true that this basically could not have happened on a U.S. airline because of the two people in the cockpit policy?
To that, I would say absolutely not. That is not the case. There have been cases in which people have flown their plane into the ground in the presence of other people in the cockpit. And so I don't think this rule is neither necessary or adequate, frankly, because this is such a black swan type of event, so incredibly rare. This kind of thing has never happened in a North American or European carrier before. And even if you look at the entire world, it's very rare. And so I don't feel like it's a burning issue that we have to address. I think something like this happens, it becomes suddenly in people's consciousness for the first time, and people feel this imperative. We need to do something about it.
You're suggesting that there aren't regulatory changes that could prevent this kind of thing from happening. It's so rare and so dependent on one person's will to cause a catastrophic event that there's really no way to have a failsafe.
Well, what I find really troubling is this idea, all of us, which is very new, I think, in our culture, this idea that pilots are now not to be trusted, that they are people upon which we must look with suspicion, and we have to figure out how we can guard against the malicious intent of pilots. The reality is that trust in pilots is the bedrock of the entire aviation system. The pilots are the ultimate authority. And if we don't trust the ultimate authority, we really don't trust the system itself. So I think we need to perhaps think a little bit more carefully before we run down this road of how can we police the pilots.
Let's talk about the cockpit for a second,
okay,
though. Two people in the cockpit seems like it might make it harder. If you wanted to sabotage a flight, you'd have another person there trying to stop you. In the actual flying of a plane, does that potentially help prevent a catastrophe?
Yes. I mean, I can definitely see that how that point could be made. But I think we have to remember how incredibly vanishingly rare this potential that we're trying to prevent really is. And so, you know, if it's one in 100 million versus one in 50 million, I think that's what we're kind of
right.
looking at. So I don't think we should take comfort in feeling that we've solved the problem.
At the same time, you know, it's understandable, predictable that drastic reactions would be taken, that people want to do something.
Yes.
That flight MH370, which you've written about,
right,
was covered exhaustively and ad nauseum for months when that plane disappeared by cable news. And the media environment seems to be maybe one of the things that's changed. Maybe aviation safety hasn't changed all that much.
Oh, absolutely. I think MH370 has radically changed the way we think about aviation. And I think it's prepared us to become very anxious about airplane incidents that before might have gotten a day or two of coverage. But now, I mean, I went on air for 2 weeks or something after the AirAsia crash in December, and that turned out not to be that strange of a crash. But I think what we're worried about are these kind of mysterious, baffling cases that are even more troubling than a normal plane crash because they seem to resist explanation.
And they make us have the desire and the need to react. Investigations are going on and questions still swirling around the crash of Germanwings Flight 9525 in the mountains of France. Jeff Wise is the author of the Kindle single, The Plane That Wasn't There, Why We Haven't Found MH370. Thank you.
Thank you.
Big news in Washington today as Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid from Nevada announced that he's not seeking re-election in 2016. It's a surprise move that leaves open a leadership spot for Democrats in the Senate.
We've got to be more concerned about the country, the Senate, the state of Nevada, than us. And as a result of that, I'm not going to run for re-election. My friend Senator McConnell, don't be too elated. I'm going to be here for 22 months, and you know what I'm going to be doing? The same thing I've done since I first came to the Senate.
That's Reid making his announcement in a video posted to YouTube today. Reid also insisted the decision had nothing to do with a recent accident he had on some exercise equipment.
The decision that I've made has absolutely nothing to do with my injury. It has nothing to do with my being minority leader. And it certainly has nothing to do with my ability to be reelected, because the path to reelection is much easier than it probably has been any time that I've run for reelection.
New York Senator Chuck Schumer is the likely replacement for Reid. He issued a statement almost immediately following Reid's announcement. It said, his character and fundamental decency are at the core of why he's such a successful and beloved leader. He's so respected by our caucus for his strength, his legislative acumen, his honesty and determination. He has left a major mark on this body, this country, and on so many who have met him, gotten to know him, and love him. Some glowing praise there from New York Senate Democrat Chuck Schumer, the likely successor to Harry Reid for Senate Democratic leader. Joining me now from Washington is Reid Wilson, staff writer for The Washington Post. Hi, Reid.
Hey, Todd.
Reid, Harry Reid has been in Congress since 1982. He's been Democratic leader since 2005 in the Senate. He's been majority leader, of course. This is huge news for Democrats and giant news for 2016. Nevada's a swing state.
Giant news for Democrats for 2016 and for the United States Senate. Harry Reid's tenure as majority leader was really marked by a Senate that didn't do a lot of work and got away from what we call regular order, that sort of what you think of as legislative business, you know, when a bill goes through a committee and then is marked up and goes to the floor and all that. And under Reid's rule, he really controlled the Senate with an iron fist. He didn't allow the minority to offer a lot of amendments. Democrats loved him for it. Republicans hated him for it. And he became one of the more polarizing figures in, as you say, a state that is a real swing state. He has won his all five elections with less than 51% of the vote, including one election, which he won by only about 600 votes.
And that also means that a lot of interests around the Nevada Senate race, including the Koch brothers, were getting ready to pour millions and millions upon millions of dollars into Nevada to defeat Harry Reid. Now, he also said he didn't want to suck the money out of the race when Democrats have a good chance of retaking the Senate next time.
Yeah, and Democrats do have a good chance of taking the Senate. They need to take back at least four seats if they keep the White House, five seats if they don't keep the White House, if they lose the White House, in order to get the 51 they would need to control the Senate outright. They are running against Republicans in seven states that Barack Obama won twice. A lot of those states are some really competitive places like Pennsylvania and Illinois and Wisconsin. And Harry Reid was one of two Democratic senators who was probably going to face a really difficult challenge. There's nobody in Nevada who doesn't know Harry Reid. There's nobody who doesn't have an opinion of him. He narrowly survived in 2010, which was such a good year for Republicans because he ran against a really lousy Republican candidate. This time around, Republicans weren't going to make that mistake, but Reid was going to have an advantage because in a presidential year, more people tend to turn out. That tends to be good for Democrats, especially in a state like Nevada, where so much of the electorate is Hispanic.
Now, this is also huge news for one Senator Chuck Schumer, who is the number three Democratic leader from New York right now, who is widely thought to be next in line to be leader. Is that true? What does this mean for Schumer?
Yeah, this is the funny and sad part, sort of. Schumer used to be roommates, lived together for a long time with the number two Democrat in the Senate, Dick Durbin. Almost nobody on Capitol Hill thinks Durbin has the votes necessary to become the next Democratic leader. It's almost certain that Schumer's going to become the leader. What it means is Democrats are going to have a leader who is extremely political. Chuck Schumer knows his politics very well and has been involved in the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee as sort of the behind-the-scenes wizard for a very long time. And Democrats are going to have a leader who is used to working with Republicans. You know, Schumer is not, he may be political, but he's not as partisan as some others would, some other senators in the Democratic ranks. So I think there is at least the opportunity for a momentary reset that will restart relations in the U.S. Senate. We'll see how Chuck Schumer works with the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, and you know, hopefully get the gears moving again.
Reid Wilson, before we let you go, you know, there are going to be a lot of voices on TV and in Washington today who say they saw this coming. The truth is nobody saw this coming. Harry Reid swore he was running.
Yeah, I'm not terribly convinced about that. There were hints for a long time. He was pretty severely injured in an exercise accident on New Year's Day. He cited that injury in his announcement. And, you know, take him at his word.
Yep. He swore up and down he was running, but maybe people knew. Yeah. That Harry Reid, who's in his 70s, might not. Reid Wilson, staff writer for The Washington Post. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Breakdown, baby. All right, there is no way you can or would want to watch all of the junk that people share with you on Facebook every day. That's why we have Sean Ramos-Ferran. He hangs five for us every week with the Friday Five, the five online things that you should check out. This is curated, people. It's a time saver. Sean, welcome.
Hey, Todd, how are you?
Sean is the host of the podcast Sideshow, which comes to you from the same people who make the program Studio 360. Sean, great to have you here.
Great to be here.
All right, let's start with number one.
One.
Charlie XCX dropped this music video this week for her song Famous.
I'm a huge fan of Eric Wareheim and his partner, Tim Heidecker. Mm-hmm. They make crazy stuff. Some of it's cringeworthy. How's this?
Indeed. The song's very poppy. The video's seemingly very poppy, but then quickly goes to a bizarre and dark and sort of weird but on-point place, as most of their stuff does. It sort of ends up skewering, like, internet culture, emojis, selfies, selfie sticks, YouTube itself, and ironically, it debuted at the YouTube Music Awards this week. But it's worth 3 minutes of your time for sure.
Eric Wareheim usually is. Now, speaking of YouTube, which means Google.
Yes.
This is number two.
Two.
According to Wired, a reporter at the Daily Dot this week sent Google / YouTube a press inquiry, and Google / YouTube responded using an animated GIF of a six-year-old looking girl going like, shrugging her shoulders, waving her hands in the air, saying, I don't know. And that's maybe uncomfortable from Google, you know, that controls our phones, our email, our internet, our everything.
Got a question? Figure it out.
Do it yourself.
All right, number three.
Three.
Number three, you can learn a lot about a movie by watching its first and final frames, especially next to each other. Something I didn't know until a Vimeo user named Jacob T. Swinney juxtaposed a bunch of the first and final frames of movies this week for us. Everything from 2001 A Space Odyssey to The Master to Boyhood.
Talk to me.
Some of them are super revealing, like The Usual Suspect.
He's gone.
The first thing it reveals is how much thought goes into the first and final frames of a movie.
That's so cool.
It's awesome. 5 minutes of your time. Great way to spend it. I hope it's a franchise. I hope this is the first of many.
I'm on it. Number four.
Four.
Speaking of franchises, the seventh Fast and Furious movie comes out next week.
Oh, thank God.
It don't matter if you win by an inch or a mile. Winning's winning.
And Vin Diesel gave this amazing interview to Variety. I think if you get the print version, it's their cover story. But it circulated a lot online because he says incredibly ridiculous things. And here's the one that I want to share with you. And I'll try and do my best Vin Diesel here. It will probably win Best Picture at the Oscars, unless the Oscars don't want to be relevant ever. He said that about Furious 7.
I feel
7.
Like Vin Diesel is here in the studio with me. It's amazing.
I am Groot.
Yo, what's up with your boy?
Okay, number five.
Five?
2 weeks ago, I came to John here to... I presented him with a mashup of the Seinfeld theme song, that slap-heavy bass thing, with Limp Bizkit's Break Stuff. He was scared. I played it for him.
Just one of those days, I remember.
Yes, indeed. And then last week, I came to him with the new Kendrick Lamar album and said, this is revelatory, and there's this amazing song called King Kunta. And of course, this week, we have the Seinfeld slap bass heavy theme song and Kendrick Lamar. They've been mashed together. It's like full circle.
It's a trilogy. Sean Ramos-Ferran, in the future, all of our music will be mashed up with Seinfeld.
I think so.
This is where we're headed.
We're calling it the Jerry Roll up at Studio 360, like the Rick Roll. This is a thing. We found like at least 6 or 7 examples. It's apparently just a new, wonderful thing that the internet loves to do.
Next, Gregorian Chants, matched with a Jerry Roll. I can't wait either. Sean Ramos-Ferran is host of Sideshow from Studio 360. He joins us every week with his beautifully curated Friday Five. Thanks,
we go now
to the spiraling situation in Yemen. Saudi airstrikes are targeting the Iranian-backed Shiite rebel group known as the Houthis. That's forced Yemeni President Hadi to flee the capital. A 10-nation coalition is carrying out that assault, and now Egypt says it is prepared to send ground troops to Yemen if necessary. United States involvement is more complicated, however. Arizona Senator John McCain criticized the Obama administration in a news conference on Thursday.
Our closest allies in the region no longer trust us that they wait a matter of a few hours before beginning a major military operation.
But the Saudi ambassador, Adel Al-Jubeer, says the White House has been responsive.
We have had very fruitful and very productive discussions with the U.S., and we are very pleased with the outcome of those discussions.
The United States has deep interests in Yemen, including fighting active terrorist organizations. Gregory Johnson is writer-at-large for BuzzFeed. He's also author of The Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia. Welcome back, Gregory.
Thanks so much.
Gregory, the White House has said that it is helping Saudi Arabia in its airstrikes with intelligence and logistics. What does that mean?
Right. So the White House announced that it was setting up what it called a joint planning cell to give Saudi intelligence and logistics. I'm not sure how much the U.S. is actually helping. There were certain parts of the U.S. military that apparently didn't even know that Saudi was going to strike Yemen until about an hour before the air raids actually took place. And in fact, much of the intelligence that the U.S. often uses in Yemen for things like drone strikes and so forth, a lot of that comes from Saudi sources on the ground.
So our intelligence comes from them, and now we're out of Yemen, essentially. All of our troops are out. The embassy's closed. This is a Saudi show now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the U.S. closed its embassy in the capital of Sana'a in February, and then just last week, the U.S. withdrew about 125 special operations advisors that had been at a military base in southern Yemen that they used to help coordinate things such as drone strikes as well as other counterterrorism activities. And now the U.S. is almost completely gone from Yemen. And of course, when the U.S. leaves, that doesn't mean that all of Yemen's problems leave. It just means that the U.S. is in less of a position to influence or to address those challenges.
And one of those big challenges, of course, the biggest one for us is AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, responsible for the underwear bombing over Detroit, possibly behind the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris. They are operating in Yemen. That's our biggest target. Now, one final piece of news, Gregory, reports that American intelligence files on Al-Qaeda fighters and operations in Yemen have now fallen into the hands of Houthis, of the rebels in Yemen.
Right. So what you have in Yemen is a very messy and a multi-sided war. So you have the Houthis, which is against the internationally recognized president of Yemen, President Hadi. But the Houthis have also been fighting a war against Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So these two groups have been carrying out Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and the Houthis have been fighting back and forth against one another. And I think the real concern for the United States right now is that what's going to happen is if Yemen does devolve into open war, something like we see in Syria or something like we see in parts of Iraq, Al-Qaeda is going to gain a lot of strength from tribal fighters who join their ranks as a way to fight the Houthis. And then what will happen is as the war progresses, more and more foreign fighters will be drawn to Yemen. And of course, those foreign fighters carry passports that often allow them to travel back to the West. So this is really a nightmare scenario for Washington and for planners and policymakers in the West.
And disturbingly similar to the exact same answer you could have given for Iraq with the fight against ISIS and for Syria and even possibly for Libya.
Yeah, and I think the difference in Yemen, or at least the difference right now, is those conflicts are all very bad. They're very horrible. They're attracting a lot of fighters, but they've so far, with a few exceptions, remained largely contained within those particular countries. I think the danger, if Saudi Arabia actually carries out a ground invasion into Yemen and Iran is drawn more into the conflict in Yemen, is that this could be a situation where the war in Yemen doesn't just remain in Yemen, but it starts to suck all of these regional powers in and then, in fact, goes outside the borders of Yemen. And that would, of course, be a disastrous scenario for everyone involved.
Gregory Johnson, writer-at-large for BuzzFeed, author of The Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Todd.
This podcast of The Takeaway is brought to you by the fine folks at WNYC and Public Radio International. I'm John Hockenberry. Our partners include WGBH, Boston Public Radio, and The New York Times. If you'd like to know more about the program, you can find out more about me and the team at thetakeaway.org.
You had me at hello.
You won't take me seriously just because I'm 17.
Studying is hard and boring.
Boring?
I heard you were looking for me. Nobody's forcing you to be here. You have a choice. You can stay or you can leave. Come on, ladies. There's no wrong answer.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's Friday, and on Fridays we talk movies. This week we have a family flick about an alien on Earth. It's a buddy comedy in which one of the guys, oh, also, that one's a buddy comedy of sorts. We also have another buddy comedy. It's not animated. It's about a guy who's going to prison. With me in the studio is Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer, culture producer here at The Takeaway. Together, they host the Movie Date podcast. Welcome, guys.
Hey, Todd.
Two buddy movies of a kind, and we'll get to them. But first, trivia, which I've brought with me. You're not going to answer now. You're going to keep your answer in your head. We'll get the answer at the end. Steve Martin co-stars in one of the movies we're talking about today. That's Home, right? Let's go back to 1983, and you're going to name this movie.
This operation that you're about to perform, I feel, is very ill-advised. No surgeon should ever operate on a patient that he has personally injured. It would make him too emotionally involved.
Don't you think I'm aware of that? But there's only one other person I'd trust to perform this operation, Beckerman.
Well, Dr. Beckerman was murdered in Europe, you know that.
Exactly. Not only is he dead, he's 6,000 miles away.
Now, don't tell me what movie that is now. Keep it in your head. Rafer's nodding. We're going to come back to it after we discuss this week's releases. Rafer and Kristen, let's go to our first release home. This is Jim Parsons, famous from
Big Bang Theory.
Big Bang Theory. My God, I watch it all the time. And just Sheldon Cooper, of course. Rihanna, Steve Martin, as we mentioned in it. Let's listen to a clip.
Gotcha.
What for are you did this?
I am Boov.
I know what you are.
Yeah, can I come into the out now?
No, you cannot come into the out now.
But I can. You are just having to take away the piece of wood.
An alien lands on Earth, Kristen, and is all alone.
Oh, yes. He's from an alien species called the Boov, and they are escaping their enemies. They've come to Earth, and they've relocated all the humans to Australia so that they can enjoy the rest of the planet. Their enemies continue to chase them. And this particular Boov, O, played by Jim Parsons, is kind of a social outcast. He screws up things a lot, but he happens upon this unlikely friendship with this human girl played by Rihanna, and it starts off very frenetically, kind of all over the place, you know, sparkle lights, explosions, this and that, chases. But I do have to say, once their friendship starts to really develop between the two of them, I found it really touching and a very enjoyable film. And just on a side note, he's adorable. He's super cute. He's got these four legs and he's got these floppy ears. He's very cute.
Rafer, I like to take my niece and nephew to movies like this, but it always raises the question of whether there's enough in here for adults to be able to sit through.
I mean, I think if you've been to kids' movies before, this will probably remind you of a lot of them. I think it's very noisy. It moves very quickly. There's a lot of pop songs. It's kind of the usual stuff. I think the movie is fine on its own terms. I didn't enjoy it quite as much as Kristen did. It's based on a novel called The True Meaning of Smeck Day, which is a much more complicated and deep-reaching novel. It's actually a pretty pointed allegory about colonialism and the American history and what we did to the Native Americans. And it makes those points very forcefully. It's a really interesting novel. You won't find any of that in the movie. It's been completely stripped out. And I think as the movie, you know, again, standing on its own two legs, the movie is perfectly fine as a kid's movie. I was not bowled over by it. My kids enjoyed it.
So maybe they loved it.
Take the kids, turn around and read the book if you really want to get the full force of what the story could be about. Let's go on to Get Hard. Now, this is Will Ferrell and Kevin Hart. Will Ferrell is a rich guy who gets caught being bad, I guess, on Wall Street or at his hedge fund, somewhere like that. And he's going to go to prison. He needs help to get hard, right, to learn how to be a con. Listen.
We're about to simulate a prison riot. Understand that this is the most dangerous situation there is. Prisoners are scared. Guards are scared. The key to surviving is to not freak out.
Good Lord. What's going to happen?
Cecilio's just going to throw some stuff at you. Some roosters, some mainly homeless guys, whatever he's got. He's really excited about this.
Wait, don't I get body armor?
No, we don't have that type of time. Cecilio!
Now, this is a premise, Rafer Guzman, that I think could really work. I like what they're going for here.
Okay, so as you said, Will Ferrell plays a guy who's a one percenter. You know, he's a hedge fund manager. He gets sentenced to prison. The joke here is that he turns to the nearest black guy he knows, played by Kevin Hart, thinking, well, of course he's been to prison because he's black. And the joke is that, in fact, he has not. He's just a squeaky, clean family guy who's trying to start his own business. But he sees an opportunity for some money and decides to pose as a former prisoner and educate Will Ferrell. The movie has come into some controversy. When it premiered at South by Southwest, someone stood up in the audience and said this movie is racist and included an expletive in that comment. I do think it's about as offensive as most R-rated comedies are. I do think the stereotypes are a little tired. I think the gay panic jokes are a little tired in this film. But I think it's mostly broad comedy. It's slapstick. It's I think Will Ferrell and Kevin Hart both play the type very well. I think it's fine as a comedy. I wasn't hugely offended by it. I was as offended as I usually am by a Hollywood movie.
So
a
middling endorsement. I mean, fine as a comedy is pretty below the bar of what a Will Ferrell comedy has been in the past, Kristen.
Well, you know, I actually liked this movie. I have to say that, you know, yes, there are some offensive moments, but what are you going to expect? It's a Kevin Hart, Will Ferrell movie. Are you expecting this to be highbrow? Is it going to be a Farewell to Arms? What are you thinking? It's going to be a little bit offensive. It's going to be a little bit wacky. It's going to be kind of a bromance, and it's going to be ridiculous. There's going to be a little bit of nudity. There's going to be some swearing and some bodily function jokes, and that's exactly what it is. But I do have to say, like Home, it also has a heart, and that's kind of what holds it together in the end, I think, is the relationship between these two guys. And it's hard not to like them. And I'm saying that as somebody who's not the biggest Kevin Hart fan, that I actually really liked him and his relationship with Will Ferrell in this movie.
All right. Now, just quickly before we go, we'll get to one other movie. Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper are back together. Rafer, you saw the movie Serena. It's a period piece. about depression here in North Carolina. What did you think?
Well, here you have two of the hottest stars in Hollywood together again in this, you know, period piece romance, very expensive looking film. And I think there's a reason that most people have not heard of this film and they're not aware that it's coming out. It's already been on VOD. I just got to say shortly, it's really boring and not very much fun to watch, which is too bad because you've got two of these great, great stars in
sure.
it. But I cannot recommend this film.
Okay. Rafer does not recommend Serena starring Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper. Now, back to trivia, you two. Steve Martin is in the movie Home, which we discussed at the top of the movie segment. In 1983, he was in the movie playing the surgeon. You heard his argument with his boss at the hospital. 1983, Kristen Meinzer, I'm going to give you a shot. What was that Steve Martin comedy?
Is that The Man with Two Brains?
That is The Man with Two Brains. Kristen Meinzer got
well
one.
Well done.
Now, a little bit of a bonus if you can. You won't get this one. What was the name of the surgery that Steve Martin's character pioneered?
Too tough for you.
That's the cranial screw top. Sorry, you two. But you got it, Kristen. Good for you. You didn't get the bonus. Kristen Meinzer's culture producer, The Takeaway. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. They are both co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast. Thanks, guys. Have
Thanks,
a great weekend.
God.
You're going to want to get used to hearing the word banjo, and I'm not talking about the folksy West Virginia country musical instrument. No, I'm talking about the social media company. Banjo describes itself as the world's largest collection of social signals. They're organized by time and location and content. Now, this company has a valuation of $100 million right now, and that doesn't seem like much in the world of Twitter and Google, but that figure is going to go up, and it's probably going to go up fast. Now, Banjo's organizing principle is simple when you think about it. Instead of experiencing social media through the personalities and institutions that we follow, like on Twitter or, for instance, a hashtag, what if instead you could view the web geographically, seeing groups of posts and trends by location, where they're happening, that earthquake, the protest, the nuclear meltdown, as it happens by location? Well, it's a recipe that news organizations have already latched onto, and financial services industries, marketers, and especially government agencies could be next. Damian Patton is the founder and CEO of Banjo, and he joins me now. Hi, Damian.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
Well, it's great to have you, and the concept is fascinating when you first start to read about it and kind of visualize it for yourself. I'm on Twitter. A lot of people are. You follow a hashtag or, oh, I like that guy. I like his tweets. What's the advantage of doing it by location? What's the sort of the paradigm shift here?
As someone who's on the radio now and you're reporting on something that's going on, it's going on somewhere, right? And that's a location. And by knowing the things that are happening there, knowing the people that are there that are sharing that information, you actually have another set of eyes and ears on the ground at a place that you're not able to be at now that can report it as if you were there firsthand. So the advantage is massive.
And if enough people in a certain place, like let's say, for instance, near the finish line of the Boston Marathon when a big event happens, are posting and tweeting, Banjo knows first.
That's exactly right. I mean, in the case of the Boston Marathon, what happened there was obviously there was an explosion. We actually do things a little differently at Banjo. So it's not just about hashtags and keywords. In fact, our first order of magnitude is by the location. So it was on Boylston Street in Boston. And so we looked at Boylston Street. And then it's by what we call photo recognition or photo classification. We're able to look at those photos that are shared from the Boston Marathon explosion. And we were able to say, hey, there's a fire coming out of this area or an explosion coming out of this area with no keywords or hashtags. And then we're able to zoom in and see who else is publicly sharing content from this area. And most of it is not going to have a keyword or a hashtag about the event because, quite honestly, an event like that is chaotic in the beginning. And so people are just trying to make sense of what's happening. And so they're just posting as quickly as they can to share things that are going on. And Banjo is able to bring you right there to that scene because we, number one, we know the location. But more importantly, we were able to detect that there's a big event had happened there, even if it's just a single photo. Because we know in that photo there was an explosion, and there's not supposed to be an explosion on Boylston Street, and our photo recognition software is capable of knowing that.
So people have described this service as sort of having a permanent drone in the sky, like always with its eye fixed on a location. In this case, it may be the world if everybody's got their geotagging on. Damien, there's another technology that the military uses. They call it the Gorgon Stare, which is basically a drone that circles a city that has 24-hour unblinking surveillance. The Gorgon has an unblinking eye. You're offering that in a much broader way, and that might be unsettling to a lot of people.
Yeah, I can see your point about that. But what Banjo's doing is just sharing what people are already publicly wanting to get out there. And in fact, we're the only company that I know of that has a patent that protects users' privacy with their data after it's been shared, meaning you share that public post on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, et cetera. Well, maybe a day or two later, you decided you didn't want that to be public. You wanted to change your settings. We go back in time and make sure that all the posts that you discover have the current privacy settings set by the user to make sure you protect their individual privacy.
At the same time, Damien, if I'm in the FBI or somewhere in the Justice Department, I might be really tempted to want to know what the content of a protest meeting is down in the city hall, what the content of a protest meeting is at the rec hall in Ferguson or in some other town where maybe something that I perceive as subversive activity is about to kick off. And that's a whole different conversation.
It is. And at Banjo, what we've decided to do is we've publicly decided not to share our platform or information with government agencies of that nature. And the reason why, again, it's about people knowing how their information is going to be used and what it's going to be used for. You're publicly sharing. You're sharing because you want people to know that you're reporting on something, you're having a good time somewhere, or you're reporting on a news event somewhere. And so we've decided to use it for those purposes, meaning with the brands, letting brands use it to discover the people that are talking about their product, or use it with the news and media to be the reporters on the scene, if you will. But we've just decided as a company, with our great team of people and including myself, that we're just not going to share with those agencies as a part of our business model.
Well, being seen and being heard is taking on a whole new meaning in the world of geotagging and in the world of Banjo, which can really, in a way, see the entire world and locations all at once based on social media. Damien Patton is founder and CEO. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate being here.
And you can read a lot more about Damien and his company in a piece called God's Eye View that's in Inc. magazine this month. And here's something for you to take with you today. NASA astronaut Scott Kelly is about to make U.S. spaceflight history by spending a record-breaking 342 days on the International Space Station. Robert Perlman, editor of CollectSpace.com, a space history website. Robert, are we really making history here? I mean, the Russians have done this, right?
There have been four cosmonauts who have spent more than a year in space before. This will be the first time that an American has logged a full year or close to a full year off the planet during one mission.
So maybe what we haven't learned from the Russian physiology, we might learn from the American physiology. But speaking of physiology and maybe genetics, Scott Kelly is a twin of Mark Kelly, who's also an astronaut. What can we learn from studying two twins, one of whom is going to space for over a year?
It's going to allow us to have comparative biology. It's a unique opportunity. It's the first time that NASA's had a twin in space and a twin on the ground at the same time. They will be able to compare their microbiological makeup, like the microbes in our GI tract. They'll be able to compare the physical changes that go on with in terms of functioning and the way that microgravity affects an individual's ability to function, as well as their bone mass and muscle mass and vision. So it'll give a side-by-side comparison. Mark Kelly on the ground won't follow the same regiment as Scott Kelly in space, but they're twins, so there will be something to learn from their two experiences.
Doesn't relativity say that Scott Kelly will be younger when he comes back after hurtling around the Earth for a year?
A tiny fraction of a bit, yes.
A little bit younger. They'll have to study the gap. Robert Perlman, editor of CollectSpace.com, a space history website. Thanks, Robert. If you want to listen back to anything you heard on today's show, you can go on our website at thetakeaway.org. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.